Bill Alcoholic. Well, the countdown lady's a little wacky, don't you think? Don't you just love AA? I mean, how can you be bored in Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, if you're sitting out there this morning and you're bored, it really is because you're boring. This is better than any reality television show they'll ever come up with. I mean, this is better than Swamp People. I mean, in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the truth that the inmates are running the asylum. You know, I mean, we are the counselors. You'll stop and think about this. You'll hear a little bit of my story, which I hope I don't dwell on too much. But I've been in a mental institution twice. I've been married 3 times. And people ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA, you know. Plus the fact, you know, whatever advice you give them couldn't possibly be worse than what they're planning on doing in the first place. It's great. My sobriety date is March the 27th, 1985. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, where the men are men and the sheep are nervous. We're sober correctly there. We don't care about how your day went. Now, if you start sharing about your girlfriend, we'll just clap till you stop. I love my home group. Some people say, you know, it's the best group in AA. I don't know if mine's the best group in AA, but we sure have a lot of fun, man. And I've been going there for 28 years. I'm afraid not to go. It's been working out so far. You know, I like to start off by making a little apology to everybody. I'm a firm believer that when you come and do these conventions is that you show up when it starts and you attend and you listen to the other speakers and you go to what's going on and then you come all the way to the end until the last speaker and then you leave. You make yourself available. People invite you to come here. You know, it's not about taking a vacation, except for this weekend. I mean, it's Niagara Falls. And Karen and I have never been here to Niagara Falls, and we never had a honeymoon. And she explains to me that this does not count as a honeymoon. But we got here on Thursday, and we've been just sightseeing. We've been over the falls, down the falls, behind the falls, around the falls, you know, and the weather is just incredible, and what a beautiful city you people live in. And we've just had a marvelous time. It's really been quite special. Angie talked last night about... And I can't sing, so don't worry. She talked last night about, isn't it amazing that she's here, given where she came from? I think all of us can say that. You know, nobody has a corner on the market on that. Some are worse than others. I have a very checkered past. I scarred myself profoundly. I have end-stage liver disease, and I'm on a transplant list. And I get tired really easy. And for the first time since I've been sober, I've had to cancel a few of these in the last couple of years. My liver failed on me, and I've been in a situation where I've been frightened for my life. So I want to tell you something. it's really special that I'm here this weekend. You know, I mean, I'm just really goddamn happy to be here. And I'm up. There's my liver buddy Harvey over there, you know. You know, we're transplant bros. You know? He got two livers. Shit, I'm cooler than Harvey. I just want one. I'm thinking about moving to Canada. You know, maybe. You know. But it's neat just to be up and outside and breathing and sitting in the sun. And sometimes we take stuff for granted, don't we? We get used to being sober. We just get used to it. It's just how we live now. It's like not a big deal. And we forget that we were saved. You know, one of the reasons you stay involved in AA is to remember. Remember what it was like when that newcomer comes in. You know, some of us, we've been around a while, we have a tendency to avoid them because they smell and stuff. You know, and I think we need to get close to them. We need to be up close and remember. The whole world wants to get born again. Everybody wants to get born again. Here we are. This is what it looks like. This is what it looks like to be born again. To have the experience of that, not the understanding of it. The experience of truly being reborn. I mean, a righteous second chance. Maybe third chance. Maybe fourth chance. For many of us. I was sitting with an Indian guru some years ago, a pretty important guy. He was over in the U.S. giving some talks, and my friend was connected to this man, and so we went and listened to him, and afterwards the three of us were just sitting in this little back room talking. And I'm talking away, and he looks at me, and he starts laughing. Because that's what they do, they laugh at us. I said, what are you laughing at? And he goes, you know, the rest of them, he says, I just love you alcoholics and drug addicts. I said, why is that? And he goes, well, the rest of them out there are trying to get awakened. You're just trying to figure out what the hell happened. You know? And I think, isn't that true? We wander around here and go, what the hell happened? How did I end up here? Why do I like it here? You know? I mean, I used to drink all the time, and now I don't. What? You know? I'm registered for a liver at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in L.A., and they do this big induction process. They want to be sure they know who you are and whether or not they're going to give you, whether you qualify morally to get a liver from them. And so one of the things is they have a psychiatrist that comes in and checks you out. And my wife, Karen, looks at me before this psychiatrist came in. She says, do not mess with this psychiatrist. I looked at her and I went, what? She goes, do not mess with this psychiatrist. This is important. So this woman's going down the list and she's asking me questions, this and that. And she says, it says here that you haven't drank, and at the time it was like 25 years. I said, yeah, I haven't drank 25 years. And she says, so you conquered your addiction. And I looked at her and I looked at Karen and she glared at me. And I went, yes, I conquered my addiction. Pulled myself up by the bootstraps and just straightened out like we should, you know. I've yet to hear anybody tell that story. You know. And I woke up on Monday and I go, today's the day. Going to AA. That's it. I'm done. You know, you just rarely hear that story, if ever. And, What a remarkable journey this is. I think the sober part's a lot more interesting than the drunk part. When you're awake and paying attention, more interesting stuff happens. I have a guy that I sponsor that says, I started drinking at 12, but I didn't drink like a normal 12-year-old. My buddy Tom Cook. I give him credit for that. I think that he first time I heard him say that, I about fell out of my chair. Because I think whenever we started, we can pretty much, most of us can say that. Some people just started off kind of normal and they grew into it. And, you know, I didn't know there was a line. I never stepped over a line. I started drinking at 14 or 15 years old. It became a lifestyle within a month. You know, I mean, I just went after it. And from that point forward until I was 37 years old, not much happened to me. You know, I mean, by the time I was 17, I was a bad drunk in high school. I was 17 years old. I had the big jacket and the greasy Levi's and the boots and the, you know, I was a bad kid. I carried a gun. 17, I carried a gun. You know, I just was a bad kid, and I didn't get raised by mean parents. Nobody beat me or raped me or anything. I have no idea where that came from. I had rage since I was a small, young age. I mean, all of us tell the same story. All of us tell the same story. We say long before we ever drank, we had problems. You know, we felt separate from. We didn't feel part of. The aliens had dropped us off and were waiting for the mothership to return, you know? And some of us are still waiting, you know? And we talk about that like it's some kind of unique experience, like it's unique to alcoholism. A lot of times when you hear the story being told, you'll hear somebody say that, use this term, alcoholic thinking. Like, long before I drank, I had alcoholic thinking. As if there is such a thing. I mean, you repeat something around here often enough, everybody just picks it up. You're like, well, yeah, I got alcoholic thinking. That's my problem, you know. The only place you ever hear that term, alcoholic thinking, is in Alcoholics Anonymous. The professional community never uses that term. Dr. Silkworth wrote a paper on it in 1940. You can imagine him sitting in the early AA meetings. He hears that term and he goes, oh, God, they're making stuff up now. I've unleashed them on the world, you know, and they're talking like they know something now, you know. They've determined that they have special thinking. And he wrote a paper on it. You know what the rest of the professional community say about us? They say that we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we go, no! I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking, and it's never going away, and you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. Special thinking. And after 28 years of relatively deep research, I'm pretty well convinced that we're just all emotionally immature. And the difference between us and the other kids that we grew up with, because if you've ever had the experience of raising teenagers, they're aliens. You know, 10, 11, you're their favorite toy. Somewhere around 12 or 13 years old, you can tell by the look in their eye that you are the stupidest creature they've ever run across in their life. That you just don't get it, and you never will. You know, and the difference between us and those other kids is that we medicated that feeling, and we never grew out of it. And now we're sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to grow up now. And the chances of us doing that and looking good are really slim. You know, we're all going to get an opportunity to wear the clown suit around here. You know, the big nose and the feet and the baggy pants. We're all going to do it. We've all done it. If you've been sober any length of time, you've made a complete ass of yourself in front of a room full of complete assholes. You know? And that is hard to do, you know. You got to work on that, you know. But at 17, you couldn't talk to me. I was gone. I was caught up in it. It was the 60s, you know. It was a great time to be getting loaded. It was a great time to be a loser. We had a uniform and everything, you know. It was very hip. And the road from L.A. to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana, and Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe, and they weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel, you know, and the young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could, you know. And You know, I can't really tell you any stories about the 60s because I've made up so much stuff over the years. I'm not really sure exactly what really happened. You know? It was. I'm just sorry I missed the whole thing. You know. And I was right there, man. I was in Golden Gate Park. I was in Haight-Ashbury. I was right around. It was all happening all around me. I was there at the time it was happening. It was incredible. You'll hear people say, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drunk. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. Because from what I understand, it was a real hoot, man. It was like, we were out there, just out there. And I got married at 18 years old, I think. I met her at Bass Lake in California, up just north of Fresno, and the Hells Angels rode into that valley on July 4th of 1966, and I found my career path. That's what I wanted to be, a badass, a gunslinger and stuff, you know. And I met this woman, and she lived up in Oregon, and so I drove her up there. She was supposed to take the bus, and we ended up getting married and having two kids. By the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. I needed a rest. And I was running with an outlaw motorcycle gang and sticking needles in my arm every day and drinking like a fish and not coming home to that family. They were on welfare. We lost a house and a couple of cars and several jobs. We lost ourselves. 22, mental institution. Short party. Short party. Everybody always says, well, you know, we always talk about party and being a party kind of guy, you know. And I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television taking notes. Party! You know. I mean, I'm having sex menage a uno. You know. There's no one else in the room. Next time somebody walks in here and says, well, I'm just a party kind of guy, ask him, how many other people were at the party? Because I think that was the whole idea behind the drinking thing. We feel this separation. We have a couple of pops, and it goes away, and we go out, and the idea was to go out and go to the party and have some fun. And we end up, you don't need any other proof that alcoholism is physiological other than that last 3 to 5 years that you and I spent out there. There's no party. We're not partying. We're just trying to make it through the day. Remember those days? Just get through the day. Remember waking up in the morning thinking, oh, God, I'm not going to make it to work again. You know, I'm not a husband. I'm not a father. I can't cut it. You know, and you feel that feeling. Many of us have had moments of clarity. Many of us have stood and looked at ourselves in the mirror in the morning, if we can actually look ourselves in the eye, which is hard to do sometimes. And you look at yourself and you go, I got to cut this out. Then the very next thought is, I need a drink. You know, and that last few years is just hell. No one would consciously do that to themselves if they had any choice in the matter at all. Because there's no party. At 22, I'm in a mental institution. Anybody else here been in a mental institution? Our former delegate. Further proof that the inmates are truly running the asylum. Look who we put in charge of stuff. Well, I didn't see too many hands, so there's a bunch of you out there going, well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me. Only those of us that have been in the mental institution know that it's not that bad. You have some sparkling conversations in the mental institution. It's a great place to look for a bride. I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Karen. She would like me to tell you that I did not meet her in the mental institution. after the mental institution. A few years ago, I was speaking up there in Salem, Oregon, is where it is. And I was on the ward that Ken Kesey worked on when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. On the ward that I was on is where they filmed that movie. Now, I'm not bragging. But some people went to college. This is all I got. I'm up there speaking at this convention. They had a dinner for the speakers on Friday night, and I'm sitting next to this long ponytail guy, and about my age, same length of sobriety. We become dear friends, and I mentioned to him, I said, I was in the mental institution over here, and he goes, I worked there. I looked at him and went, of course you do. Where else would you work, man? So he took me over there, and we toured the place, and I found my ward and took pictures next to the sign, So a buddy of mine went up there to speak at the same conference just this last year, and a bunch of those guys up there that I've gotten to know made me a t-shirt. It says, Oregon State Hospital Alumni. This is my prized possession. But I don't remember anybody talking to me about recovery then. This was 1969, I think. I don't remember anybody talking to me about AA or recovery or abstinence or sobriety or anything. They may have, and I just don't remember it. But I don't remember it. And now, in AA and Alcoholics Anonymous now, the children are coming. Have you noticed? Do you get them up here? The kids, teenagers, are coming here. And the little bastards refuse to leave. Have you noticed? A few years ago at my men's stag, about 8 or 10 years ago, the kids started showing up. Now, this is a room about 80 to 110 guys. And it's pretty, it can be intimidating because we are judging you. We're not shy about it. We don't pretend. We have opinions and we give advice sternly. And, mostly. And, the kids started showing up and they started staying and staying sober, And some years ago, this kid was standing up taking a birthday cake for a year and he's 15 years old. And you have to stand up at the head of the room and it could be intimidating. And he's up there and he gave the most right-wing pitch I've heard in years. And at the end of it, he was yelling and pointing his finger, and he says, and if you're sitting out there and you don't have a sponsor and you're not working the steps, may God have mercy on your soul. I went up and asked him to be my sponsor. Kind of scared me, For weeks after that, we were walking around looking at each other going, may God have mercy on your soul. Now, 8, 10 years later, I'll bet you 50% of that room is under the age of 24, 25 years old. I sponsor a bunch of guys that are anywhere from, say, 5 to 12 years sober, and they're still in their 20s. Got sober at 16, 17, 18, 19 years old, and they're doing everything I do. They're sponsoring people, and some of them are starting to speak around a little bit, and they're all involved in the young people, icky, yacky, yacky, paw stuff, it's amazing. It's amazing. This is what Bill Wilson wanted, Remember, he wanted hospitals across the country. There's some people in AA that say that AA's lost its edge, that it's becoming diluted, that we used to have a 75% success rate, now it's less than 5%. That's not my experience. I think we're alive and well and as vibrant and effective as we've ever been. I think we're better than we've ever been. You look at recovery around the world. Just look at the whole recovery business. There's 300 12-step programs now. When they came up with Codependence Anonymous, they came up with a program that every living human being qualifies for. Everybody can work the steps now. In whatever problem you have, there's a 12-step program you can go to. We've changed the face of the recovery industry. Recovery is part of the lexicon now. It's part of the language. People talk about drug and alcohol addiction. They talk about recovery about as much as they talk about the addiction problem. You know? I mean, there's an active conversation going on right now that's very alive and vibrant about legalizing a bunch of stuff so that we can start putting people in the recovery process rather than putting them all in prison. 70% of the prison population is drug and alcohol related. And they're finally starting to recognize it, you know? Something that we've known for a long, long time. But it's hard for the average person to understand that. But Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, is the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. There are no real issues in AA, so we have to keep recycling the old ones to give us something to talk about, you know? The drug addicts have been destroying Alcoholics Anonymous since 1935. I mean, any day now we're going to collapse under the sheer weight of the crackheads, you know? And most of them, you can see them, they're all sitting in the back of the room, you know? They're a little bit sleazier than the rest of us, you know? Hiding out in AA, you know? I mean, we were talking over dinner, I think last night, about, you know, that rule number one, if there are any rules in AA, rule number one is everyone gets to come. And you and I both know that ain't right. There's some people that should be weeded out of this thing, you know. And they ought to put me in charge of the weeding process, you know. But everyone gets to come. Everyone gets to come. A few years ago in Tehran, Iran, there was an NA convention in Tehran. 12,000 people showed up to this NA convention. The only roundup that compares with that, at least in the United States, is Founders Day. And they get somewhere around 20,000 maybe. So it's a huge convention. You can't have Alcoholics Anonymous in Tehran, in Iran, because it's a Muslim country and there is no alcohol, therefore there's no alcoholism. But you can have Narcotics Anonymous because evidently drugs are illegal, but they're not immoral. So you can have that. Now, do you suppose there's some alcoholics hiding out in the NA meetings? Any minute now, they're going to collapse under the sheer weight of the juice heads in the back of the room. You know? They're a little bit lamer than the rest of the crowd. You know? So after the mental hospital, I came back down to Los Angeles. My dad got sober when I was 6 years old. And when he died in 1999, he was 45 years sober. So I was raised in AA, on top of all my other problems. I don't recommend it. There's nothing worse than living in a house with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head. It's just not fair. And you're going around the corner to smoke one, and they're standing there going, "Where are you going?" So he let me sleep in his garage and he gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo. And I tried to clean up my act. And, you know, one of the reasons I know that my primary problem is alcoholism is because I was able to quit everything else. I just walked away from all the heroin and the acid. And I mean, you can't, you know, if you're going to be normal, you can't take acid because normal people communicate with each other. And with LSD, you don't really need the other person. You can just pretty much party with yourself, you know. And you can't find anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. There's no support for the position, you know. And so you just try to drink on the weekends and smoke pot during the week because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs, you know. Because I don't know about you, but I need something in me all the time to cushion the blow of you on me. You know, I can't do you. I just can't walk around with naked blood and interact with people. I need something in me to cushion the impact. And I was pretty well medicated for 23 or 4 years, almost every day. I missed very few days. I may not have drank every single day, but I had something in me just to make it through the day. And I met another woman because I can't ever be alone. It's a group effort getting me through life. It takes a village. And I'm just a high maintenance guy. You know, some things don't change. It's still like that today. And I met her and we tried to make a life for ourselves and got married and had 2 kids. And at 37 years old, 15 years after the mental institution, I lived in the house with that wife and those 2 small children. I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I don't know that it's like that. I've never been connected, so how would I know that I was disconnected? The alcoholic life seems like the only normal one to me because it's the only one I've ever known. It wasn't like I had a life and then I drank and I lost it all and I'm trying to regain something. I never had one. I never had a life. And I don't know any of this. I don't know that I'm not connected to you. I don't know that I'm not capable of intimacy. I don't know that I have no compassion. I don't know that my selfishness and self-centeredness is not normal. The depth of it is not like the regular human beings. All human beings are selfish. I mean, there can be virtue in selfishness. We can do wonderful things for people in order to make ourselves feel better. When you're self-centered, you never even consider that. I'm so focused on myself, but I don't know that it's like that. People tried to talk to me about that, but I couldn't hear them. I don't know what they're talking about. So at 37, I'm in the house with these people that I'm married to, and I'm a father to these 2 children, and I have no connection at all. So like any good gangster, I called my mom. Now, this is a woman by this time that had been in Al-Anon for over 30 years. Don't make Al-Anon jokes if you don't know what it is. A lot of people make a lot of stupid Al-Anon jokes because they don't know what it is. But if you know what it is, you can make some great Al-Anon jokes. Stop and think of the consciousness of an individual that would live with us on purpose. What are they thinking? Oh, this will be fun. Something to do on the weekends. Kind of like restoring an old car. But Al-Anons are prepared. They're efficient. They're ready. And my mother got to the house within a half an hour. Because you know what happens when we make that call. If we lay down and take a nap, everything changes. You wouldn't want to rush into anything. See, my story is, in a nutshell, I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's, big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. My biker nickname was Horny. I have it tattooed on my arm right here, and it's misspelled. It's H-O-R-N-E-Y. Horney. That's the level of my intellect. I'm your speaker today. I'm one of those authorities in AA. Perfect. Perfect. went to my first psychiatrist when I was 13 because I had rage. I spent a year and a half with the guy, and he introduced me to my favorite subject, me. The lifelong pursuit of self. Self-analysis can kill alcoholics. That could kill alcoholics. We need to be careful. I'm not putting therapy down, but as a treatment for alcoholism, it reaffirms the problem. You know, we're all going to work on me. That's what I need, huh? A little more attention for Billy, and then everything will be fine. I spent two tours of duty in the mental institution. I went back for a follow-up. I liked it in the mental institution, you know. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other shrinks and psychiatrists over the years. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. I know more about myself than it's safe to know. My mother, when she picked me up, took me to a recovery place in Costa Mesa, California called Starting Point, where I spent 35 days in there. While I was in there, they had me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. Well, Dr. Paul had his moccasins, you know, and I got my sign, you know. It's a little piece of rectangular cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said on there, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. And, after 35 days, they let me out. They just let us out, don't they? Like we're okay. Like, go forth, multiply. Yeah. And where do we end up? Here. This is AA, man. It's the world's aftercare program, you know. When they're all done gestalting and rolfing and primal screaming, and when all the insurance money runs out, we end up here. It's metal folding chairs, linoleum floors for the rest of our natural lives. Party. Yeah. Do you know there's no referrals from Alcoholics Anonymous? Did you know that? There's no place you go where you walk in and you say, "I'm from AA. They sent me here." I mean, that place literally doesn't exist. This is it. This is it. A couple of things happened to me that I think are just lucky. One, when I first came to AA, it didn't take very long before I realized I just liked it. I just liked it. I was intrigued by it. And I've never lost that. I find you intriguing, you know. And at this point in my life, at 65 years old and 28 years sober, I am literally, truly bored to tears with myself. But you, on the other hand, are a never-ending font of weirdness. It just never stops, you know. I mean, I was in my home group some years ago, and this new, brand new guy says in the meeting, he gets called on, and he says in the meeting, he says, "The fog is lifting, and the planes are beginning to land." Doesn't that just make the hair on the back of your neck stand up? And I was like, "Whoa, dude. I know exactly what he means." Same meeting, another new guy. He says, "I know it's an inside job. I just don't know how to get in there." These are pearls. They're just pearls. You don't get this anywhere else that I'm aware of. You know, it's incredible. And the second thing that happened to me that I feel very lucky about is I asked a man to help me, and he did, which isn't always the case. This guy is still my sponsor today, 28 years later. He's still my sponsor. I should have fired him many times. you know. But he needs me now. And, you know, I can't imagine breaking somebody else in after all this time. I feel very fortunate that he's younger than me and fairly healthy. So I got a good shot at making it to the grave and keep the same guy, you know. So, because there's no volunteers to take the job, I'll tell you that. And he says, be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock, read the doctor's opinion, make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't, and we'll discuss it. So I made notes in the margin. I showed up at his house, and he did not trust me that I'd read it, so he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, how do you sponsor people? What do you say to them? You know, what kind of advice do you give them? And the real truth about it is, especially when somebody's new, is you don't say much. You just read the book with them. He reads a page, you read a page. He reads a page, you read a page. Rule number one when you're sponsoring people, make sure they read the book. Don't trust them. Don't send them off and say, well, read this, and if you run into trouble, give me a call. Read it with them. Sit alone with them in a room where there's no other distraction. And whatever needs to be said, whatever he needs to say to you, and whatever you need to say to him will all get said. You know, you can try to plan how you're going to do it. Go ahead, plan your ass off, because then none of it will happen. You know, it's like trying to plan your pitch when you get up here to talk. You know, I'm as surprised at you as what comes out of my mouth. Sometimes I'll play the CD back and go, God, where'd you get that crap? You know, it's like some stuff just happens. You know, there's something really intriguing and by its very nature very spiritual about the interaction between you and I. And the longer you're around here, if you really love it, the more you relax into it and you just let it take you. You know, there's really not much for us to do. We talk about doing the work, do the work, do the work, do the work, you know. I mean, and there's this illusion like we're actually doing the work. You know, and so when we're actually doing the work, we start pounding on the podium and telling other people how to do it. I mean, that's part of the process. It's part of us, a process for us to grow up emotionally. Is we grab a hold of something we truly believe in and we start telling other people about it. We want to tell people. I mean, our intentions are good. You know, I mean, for years I thought that I was the light in the way. You know, I mean, the first 10 years I was sober, man. I was working hard to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. Now, I'm not exactly sure exactly what that is, but it's very weird, you know. And you know what happens when you do that? When you see us like we are, like this kind of guy like me, the arrogant, pompous, know-it-all, you know, we're going to crash and burn. It's going to hurt. And if I don't run away from it, I will come out the other side of it. The end result of humiliation is humility, you know. So you got a big ego? Let it hang out there. Don't pretend you don't have it. You ever heard guys say, the longer I'm sober, the less I know? All I can think of when I hear that is, aren't you paying attention? Where the hell have you been? I know so much more now than I knew before, you know? I mean, truly. I'm 28 years sober. I should have some shit to say to you. You know? If I don't, maybe I've been in the bathroom the whole time, you know? I mean, it's this false humility couched in spiritual pride. I'm not impressed. It doesn't impress me. You know, when I listen to speakers, I like to hear what they think about what's going on around here. Alcoholics Anonymous is the most interesting, fascinating thing that has ever happened to me in my life. It sent me all over the world. I had no idea that was going to happen. I didn't know. Who knew? How could you predict anything like that? The stuff that's happened to me in my life is truly incredible. I mean, truly it is. When I add it all up, it's like, Karen and I were talking this weekend, you know, I was kind of feeling, getting really tired and stuff like that, and she looked over at me and she goes, life's good, isn't it? And I'm going, and I looked at her and I went, yeah, we're in Niagara Falls, who knew? Here's what I think's going on, for whatever it's worth. The first step says that we're powerless. And they took it easy on us, and they just said that we were powerless over alcohol because they didn't want us to run screaming down the street. And I think the truth is, at least my experience is, that I am utterly and completely and totally without power over anybody, anything at all. Period. Nothing. I have no control. I have no power at all. And I don't require any. You know, the totality of all things requires no input from me whatsoever for the unfolding to occur. And we spend lots of time talking about the difference between my will and God's will. Stop and think about that. Just stop and ruminate on that. The arrogance of that statement. The idea that I could actually have a battle of wills with the power that drives the entire universe. You know? Just think about it, you know? Really? But isn't that the classic alcoholic position? There's the universe and me. That is literally impossible. I cannot be separate from nature. It's not possible that I'm separate. Yet I feel a separation, you know? But it's not possible. I am not of the school that believes that now that I'm sober, I've been re-empowered and I've been given the power of choice back. I understand that concept. I said it for many years. My experience does not lend itself to that. I don't think I require any power. The other half of the step says that my life is unmanageable. It says it became unmanageable. It alludes to the idea that at one time it was manageable. I don't remember that time. Maybe some people had some management skills that I missed somewhere and they actually managed their life for a while and it went along pretty well. I never happened to me, you know. I don't think my life requires any management at all by me. It just simply unfolds. The next indicated thing is obvious all the time. And I confuse it. The universe by its very nature is a giving place. I just take exception to what it's giving. I think it should be something different than it is. I'm always being taken care of. I mean, it's odd. The evidence is astounding that everything is as it should be. And we look at it and we have trouble with it. We judge things, don't we? We look across and something will occur and we'll say, that was bad. And then something else happens and we go, that was good. If you really look at nature, there is no morality in nature. There's no right or wrong, good or bad. We add that to it and somehow believe that that is actually happening in nature. But in nature, it's just all happening. There's no right or wrong or good or bad to it. And we just have, me included, have trouble with that. We don't think the lion should eat the lamb. And we try to talk to the lion and tell him that he should be vegan. He's just not paying attention. Every time he comes across a lamb, boom, it's gone, you know. The lion just eats the lamb, the poor innocent little bleeding lamb, blood splattering all over the place. It's just not right. And we look at it and we deem that is incorrect. But it doesn't change. So we make up parables that says that someday in the future, when things are good, because they're really bad right now, the lion will lay down with the lamb. Now, should that occur, I'll bet you that lamb will be nervous for eternity. Because it is the nature of the lion to eat the lamb. There's no morality to it at all. It's just the way it works. And we struggle with that. Therein lies all of our suffering. All of my suffering comes from my inability to accept things just as they are. That's the source of all of it. Nothing else has to play in my life to cause me to suffer. I look at things and I deem that they should be different than they are, and I suffer. Now life, just living life, has pain. We get sick. People leave us. Lovers reject us. People die, and we feel the pain of that loss. That's a natural experience. It's part of life. And you and I, as alcoholics, whenever we feel pain, we determine there's something incorrect that needs to be fixed immediately. And we spent a good deal of our lives making sure that we never felt a damn thing, especially pain. Then you take our medication away, and we feel the pain of regret, remorse, resentment. We try to tell people, don't jump right into a relationship. I don't know anybody who has successfully not done that. You know? Because we get the cart before the horse. We think if we get that person, then we'll be okay. Somebody will accept us. And then it doesn't work out, and we're devastated by it. I mean, devastated. So we feel pain in life. As soon as we make the determination that that event should not have occurred, that it was incorrect and unjust, now we've laid a layer of suffering over the pain that will last much longer than the pain of the event. We may very well take that to our grave. This is called resentment. And I think resentment is a first step issue. My inability to accept things just as they are. Now, when I'm new in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I can grasp this powerless concept just a little bit, just over the drugs and alcohol, that's all. That's all we're asking. If I can cop to that, the second step becomes operational. I need to align myself with the power. I need to be restored to sanity, certainly enough sanity not to drink and use, but also enough sanity to be able to begin to glimpse the powerlessness, to begin to accept it. This is the beginning of acceptance. If I can do that, the third step becomes operational. Now, the third step is interesting. We're going to turn our life and will over to what already has it anyway. I think it's nice of them to allow us to believe that we actually have some say in the matter. You know? Once again, classic alcoholic position. I've been withholding myself from the totality of all things long enough now. I'm going to acquiesce and allow you to take me. Thank you very much. No. What life and will is it talking about in the third step? The inventory. Resentments, fears, broken relationships. The end result of living a life with seeming power. You know, the end result of living a life filled with judgment about the way things should be as compared to how they are. We end up filled with resentment. We have fear. Of course we have fear because we have no plan B and this one clearly isn't working. So I hate you and I'm afraid of you at the same time. The sex list, some people call it. Really, it's a broken love relationship list. What other kind of relationship could I have if what I'm bringing to the table is resentment and fear? So we write it out. And the fifth step is the ceremony that we go through to complete the third step, really. We physically and literally turn it over. We tell ourselves, maybe for the first time in our lives. And we tell another human being, probably for the first time in our lives. And this manager, this power, here's my stuff, I'm pooped, you take it. And maybe for the first time in our lives, we begin to take responsibility for our own behavior. 6 and 7 are two paragraphs in the book, there's nothing to do, and we'll be doing that nothing for the rest of our lives, you know. And you can see what the character defects are. They're in the fourth column of the resentment list. It doesn't say what was my part. It says, what were my faults and mistakes? Even if I was molested as a child, I played no part in that. I truly was an innocent victim. Truly an innocent victim. If I'm 40 years old and I'm still carrying this resentment around, at the very least, I'm unforgiving. And I'm the one that feels the pain of it, not the perpetrator. And this is about my freedom. It's not about agreement. It's not even about understanding. It's about letting go. This is a brand new life. And it's about letting go of all that. It takes a while. It doesn't happen overnight. 8 and 9, the manager gives us our first job. He says, make amends. I'm going to help rid you of the resentments. The mechanism for ridding ourselves of the resentments that we've listed is the amends process. You take everybody on that resentment list, put them on the 8th step. be sure that you work it with someone else. Do not do this unsupervised. Going back and fixing ones that you made worse is really painful. Take it from me. And and it, once again, doesn't happen overnight. Now, 1 through 9 is about 15% of the program. And we agonize over it, don't we? We have year-long workshops about how to do the inventory and 15-column expanded versions and back to basics and turning all the statements into questions, and we do all this stuff. And I've done a lot of it. I've done workshops on it and stuff. But it's about 15%. It's sober 101. It's the bare minimum. It's what we have to do in order to develop a message that has some depth and weight so that we can begin to do the real work. This is all just preparatory. This is not grad school. You know, and this program to me is not about inventory after inventory after inventory after inventory. That's just another form of self-obsession. It was never meant to be that. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we use this thing to work on ourselves. Because the truth is, that is over. Thank God. All I need to know about my childhood is, it's over. And it was extraordinarily long. Well into my 40s. You know? 10, 11, and 12, some people say, are the maintenance steps. Maintain what? What have I got to maintain now? I think 10, 11, and 12 is where we live. 10 is the continuing inventory process. It's about self-awareness as compared to self-obsession. If what happened to me in March of 1985 is I was awakened, the rest of the journey is to take that awakening and turn it into some kind of an awareness where I'm aware that I'm awake. And maybe there's something I can actually do with this. Maybe there's a reason why I'm here. Maybe there's something I should be looking for, paying attention to. So it's a continuing inventory process. And I'll tell you something. If you sponsor people, if you really go after that, which is all there really isn't anything else to do. Everything else other than that is an activity. And the activities are all well and good. You know, I mean, I've done general service, I've done central service, I've done H&I. You know, I've been the chairman of this and the sweeper and the secretary. And I love the community of Alcoholics Anonymous, but never confuse the activity with the action. Why are we here? What's the purpose? Why are we here? Because I believe there's a purpose. Should everybody sponsor people? Absolutely. There's nothing else to do. You know, that's why we're here. And we tell ourselves all kinds of lies. We make up all kinds of excuses about why we don't. Well, I do other things. You know, my question to you is like, what? What do you do that could make up for that? The experience of that. So in 10 is self-awareness. 11 is about sucking up to the manager. It would behoove me to get close to whatever saved my life. To try to enhance that connection or that communication at some level. Meditation is not extra credit. It's in the step, you know. And in meditation, you and I can have the very real experience of watching our thoughts. We can sit quietly, breathe, focus on the breath coming in and out of our nose, and the mind will wander, because that's what it does. In the present moment, there's nothing for the egoic mind to do. Everything's fine in the present moment. It's never anything other than fine. It just is what it is. So it needs to be in the future or in the past to give it something to chew on, to work on. So it'll wander away, and you can notice that and catch it and bring it back to the breath. So who's doing the catching? Interesting question. Well, one thing's for sure. I've had the very real experience and coming to understand experientially in a knowingness that transcends the intellect. I am not my thinking mind. That is not who I am. That changes the whole game. Because we spent our entire lives trying to think differently, be differently, working on ourselves. This thing up here believes that it's me. And I believe it's me too. I'm in collusion with it. And here in AA, we say things like, my head's out to get me. We talk about it in the third person, right? Of course, we make it adversarial. I don't think it's out to get me. It's trying to help. Why would it kill the host? Right? I mean, it's trying to help. It's just stupid. It's flat and two-dimensional. You know, it creates nothing. It just takes credit for shit. Huh? All it's capable of doing is taking the past and projecting it into the future. That's all it does. They were looking for you then. They're looking for you now. You know? And in most of our cases, it comes up with a lot of negative stuff. It tells us that we're too short, we're too tall, we're too skinny, we're too fat. Whatever it tells us. It's always talking to us all the time about one thing or another. So we try to fix it. We try to change it. We try to make it think about other stuff. You know, we do affirmations. We do all this stuff. We do eye twitching therapy and we all this stuff. And we're working on it constantly, constantly working on it, trying to get it to be different. When the truth is, once you start meditating and watching it and observing it and realizing it, that you can make it stop. It will stop. It will stop. If you look at it, it can't stand to be observed and it slinks off into the bushes. And it waits for you to not be looking again and then it comes back. You know? All you have to do, all I have to do, is just ignore the damn thing. And I've got this powerful tool in meditation that I can use any time during the day. And just stop and breathe for a minute, and it'll go away. And I've had that experience. At 20 years sober, it changed my life. When you find yourself sick and in a hospital and you don't want to be there, and you start really getting depressed. And I'm not a depressive by nature. I'm a homicide guy. I'm not a suicide guy. I much prefer your death over mine. You know? And, you know, I started meditating with some intent. My sponsor told me that there will come a time, Bill, where you will be reduced to prayer and meditation. That all the smarts in the world, all the book knowledge in the world, nothing will work. You're going to have to get on your knees and ask for help. And that has happened to me more than once. At about 10 years sober, I crashed and burned. I had some kind of a mental and emotional collapse. And coming out the other side of that, my whole world changed. You will run into yourself here. I will see myself through your eyes much better than I will ever flesh it out on my own. If I don't run away, I will get to the other side. And I'm afraid of the other side. I don't know what's going to be over there. If this Bill dies off, what will replace it? But I've had the experience of crashing and burning and being reduced to prayer and meditation and walking into AA meetings with my reputation shot to hell. No more guru. No more guru. You know, I left my wife and kids 9 years sober, ran off with a woman in AA. There were a lot of people that were really happy to see me crash and burn. You know. And that woman left me and I got left in my storeroom over my office as depressed and hurt and angry and ashamed and embarrassed as I've ever been in my life. Stone cold sober. And I looked in the medicine cabinet for something to cut the pain. Thank God there was nothing there. And I called an AA buddy, not my sponsor. I called an AA buddy and he came and got me and he took me and he fed me and took me to an AA meeting. That's the love in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, they say that we don't judge. Of course we judge, but we'll help you anyway. You know? We'll walk in and look at you. You idiot. What have you done now? Get in the car. I learned how to laugh at myself. That's why we have a home group where you sit there You're never a prophet in your own land. Some guy will come to the meeting and say, is Bill C. here? And a guy will go, oh, geez. And they bring him over and go, here he is. You know, it's like, that's my home group. They love me. They don't know me this way. They've been with me for 28 years. You know, they know me. If all I'm doing is standing up at these podiums talking to you, I'm not doing much. All I can do is report to you what I'm doing. And if I'm not doing what I'm reporting to you, I'm a liar and a hypocrite. The 12th step is why we're here. The 12th step is where it all comes home. When I get on my knees and ask for help, He sends me you. It's you. I can't recover without you. I have fallen in love with you. I didn't know that I didn't have compassion. I didn't know that. And through working with you, I developed compassion because I care for you just kind of automatically. And over the years, that has grown. You want to stay in the inventory process? Sponsor people. You're always in the inventory process. I do fifth steps now with the guys that I sponsor to try to break down that barrier of sponsor-sponsee. Because really all I want is to love you. That's all I want. It's all I've ever wanted since I was a little boy. And you're my people. I found you here. It's safe here for me. This is where I belong. Sometimes I'm your teacher, mostly I'm your student. My heart, I promise you something, if you open your heart to this work, whatever prejudice you have will walk across the room and ask you for help. And you have a decision to make then. You can send it away, and you can find a lot of support for that in AA. We don't work with this kind of person or that kind of person. I didn't get raised that way. You never, ever say no. I have no idea why you're being sent to me. Maybe you need to hang on to me till you find the right person. Who knows? I don't know why you're here. I had a guy walk up to me and ask me to sponsor me. He says, I think I should tell you I'm gay. And I said, wouldn't you rather have a gay sponsor? He looked right at me. He goes, no. He says, I don't have a problem being gay, but drinking is an issue. Who knew? I used to stand up at these podiums and I'd say that if you were on medication, you weren't sober. I didn't know anything about that, but I don't require knowledge to form an opinion. I can just do it on the fly. You know? And I heard some of you say that. It seemed like a real right-wing badass opinion to have. You know, it's the old biker in me. You know, so I just started shooting off my mouth about stuff I don't know anything about. And a guy walked up to me and he says, you know, will you sponsor me? I'm bipolar and I'm on medication. Oh, jeez. But you can't say no. It's a rule. You can't ever say no. Ever. Because I'm not running the show. I'm not in charge. And I have to do something to allow the manager to run the show for me, or else I'll make decisions and I'll make judgments and my life will get small again. So I started reading the book with this guy and I had the experience of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him up off the floor. One time, 40-year-old grown man, he came across my living room and he curled up in my lap and put his head in my neck and just cried like a baby at the pain of his life. At the pain in his life. Just being alive hurt him. And I held him and rocked him. Karen walked through the living room, she goes, whoa! I mean, that'll get your attention. People have demons I don't have. You know? Now when I see that guy coming, I go, have you taken your medication? So I had an opinion, then I had an experience, and it changed my opinion. That's how it works. Now, I think all newcomers are bipolar, and everybody wants to medicate us. And I don't agree with that. There's a lot of stuff I don't agree with. But my job, do I really believe that I want the hand of AA to be there when somebody reaches out for help? Am I really responsible for that? Is it me? These people that say that we've lost our edge, is your home group growing? Are the newcomers coming in? Are you part of that process? Because my Alcoholics Anonymous is growing. It's vibrant and alive. You know, Karen sponsors a bunch of young girls. I sponsor a bunch of young guys. We try to keep them separated, you know. She tries to set them up, which is not good, given the gene pool. You know, I mean, it's like she'll say, that guy Joey, is he okay? And I go, no, Karen, none of them are okay. You know? But I live in a house like the one I was raised in. It's come full circle. It's come full circle. And I'll tell you something in all sincerity. If somewhere down the road, somewhere in the future, you hear that poor old Bill C. didn't make it, do not feel bad for me. I've been given 28 years of an incredible life. I should have been dead years ago. I was close to death in 1985. I had no idea I was so pickled, you know. But I've been given a wonderful life, and I hope it continues. I'm going to do everything in my power to continue, but don't ever feel sorry for me. What a blessing this has been for me. Nothing could compare to Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't miss the experience. People will tell you that you got to give it away to keep it. No, no. You got to give it away to even get it. If you really want it, if you really, really want it, give it away. Find somebody to give it to. Be aggressive about it. Go out or tackle them in the street. Drag them off of bar stools. Whatever you got to do, get them. Attack them. You know, get a little card that says, you know, no beer, no crack pipe, call Bill. You know, it's like, you know. I mean, go get them. Give them a hand out your phone and get their phone number. And it will change your life. Is it inconvenient? Absolutely. It is always inconvenient. It always interrupts what it is I want to do. When would I ever put myself consciously in a position to be uncomfortable? I spent most of my life trying to be comfortable. In Alcoholics Anonymous, recovery by its very nature is uncomfortable. I've just gotten used to it. I know it won't kill me now. I enjoy it. I love it, and I love you. Thank you.